This is Red Ice Creations Radio. Welcome new and regular listeners. Thank you for tuning in. I am your host, Henrik Palmgren, and this is Internet Talk Radio from Sweden, Scandinavia. The website is redicecreations.com. Frequently updated news, links, resources, and of course our radio archive. And Red Ice Creations members have full access to our entire archive, where we also have extended interviews with many of our guests. That's an excellent resource for those who want to dive deeper into the many subjects that we cover on this program. Today we are going to talk about the Knights Templar, navigation, Templar meridians, the Templars in the New World, the Vatican, the Grail, and the Viking connection, and much, much more. We have William F. Mann with us on the line, and he is the author of The Knights Templar in the New World, How Henry Sinclair Brought the Grail to Acadia, and The Templar Meridians, The Secret Mapping of the New World. Exciting and interesting material to go through here today, so it's a pleasure to say welcome to William F. Mann. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Creations Radio.
Thank you, Henrik. Welcome to Canada also. Thank you for welcoming me.
Definitely. It's great to have you here. I've been looking forward to having you on the program, so this is going to be very interesting going through some of this material. And I'd like to start to talk a little bit about your background. Now, as I understand it, you are a member of the Knights Templar, and I'd like to basically start right there and sort out some of the confusion, if you will, surrounding the different orders. I'm having a little bit trouble sorting out, the different branches of what belongs to what faction and so forth. And who'd better to ask about that than a member itself? So maybe you could help us to sort that out. As I understand it, there are two different Knights Templar. One branch is Freemasonic, and the other one is actually a Catholic order. This is of interest, of course, because of the split that we're going to talk about a little bit later in the program about. But if you will, what branch of the Knights Templar are you a member of?
Well, I am a member of the Masonic Knights Templar. And just to give you a little bit of background, I'm a member of a number of Masonic orders in both. There's two real factions within Masonry. One is the York Rite, which is the English side, and the other is the Scottish Rite side, which you can translate as being the French-Scottish side. Now, what came first is a real good question, and we may be able to dive into that a little bit further. But as you move up into these two orders, they come together at the highest level, and I am a member of the Sovereign Great Priory of Canada. Mm-hmm. It's known as the Christian Masonry Order, and I'm currently the eminent preceptor of Godfrey de Bouillon, Preceptory Number 3, located in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. In terms of the level that I've achieved, I would say it's roughly the third highest ranking level in Canada. And those the order itself, Henrik, is associated with a number of orders, Masonic orders, around the world. So it would be safe to say that I believe that the Knights Templar order that I belong to within Christian Masonry is the absolute order, and it has its continuous roots throughout Masonry, at least from the 1600s.
What you're saying there is that you're part of the Freemasonic branch, and I was just doing some basic snooping around on Wikipedia today to find out about this, and as far as I understand it and what it says there, it says that the Freemasonic branch is the United Religious, Military, and Masonic Orders of the Temple, and is also known as St. John of Jerusalem, Palestine, Rhodes, and Malta. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. I'm also a Knight of Malta and a Knight of Rhodes.
So there's
a number of combinations as they come together. Again, I have to emphasize that it's at the highest level.
Okay. Mm. But is this the same Knights of Malta as the Catholic Order branch of the Knights of Malta?
No, it really isn't. But I can tell you, as you move forward into the higher levels, there's really an intertwining or an intermixing of commonality, mm-hmm. as we find it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, and I know that at the highest levels, that there's occasional meetings between the various orders.
Sure.
So don't be mistaken that the one order is only representative of the church, while the other order is representative of Masonry. Those lines become very fuzzy as we head towards the highest level around the world.
Huh, okay, well, that's interesting because, you know, especially in regards to what is going on today and what has been going on in the past, and the reason why I wanted to kind of sort this out is because there is a merger now, so to speak, taking place between the Catholic Church or the Vatican and the Knights Templar. This was, of course, highlighted a few months ago when it was revealed that the Templars basically was going to be exonerated again by the Vatican. So the question that arises from all of this is, of course, has there ever been a big split between the orders? And is the split that prominent today? What's going on there?
There was a split. There was a split in the 12th century. And mainly that was based upon personalities. But I can tell you that the connections between the Masonic Order and the Vatican have been maintained very strongly over the last 700 years. And I can tell you the reason why they're, very simply, why we're looking to come back together. As you can very much appreciate, and it's all because, well, not all because, but because of the Da Vinci Code,
right,
coming out at the time, there's been speculation that there will soon be something discovered, something very valuable discovered. And I laugh myself. I find that not only the Vatican, but other groups, other pseudo-Templar groups, other pseudo-Masonic groups, are all lining up, waiting for these, I will call it a treasure. But in my mind, it's not a physical treasure, waiting for this treasure to be discovered, so all of these factions can lay claim that they are the rightful owners to this treasure.
And why at this time? Has the Da Vinci Code helped to spearhead this in any way and bring this into the, I guess we could call it kind of the mass consciousness? Or why at this particular time is this of interest?
I'm amazed with the Da Vinci Code. Either consciously or subconsciously, it's allowed people to accept that there is a higher level knowledge that is about to be exposed around the world. And it's really because of that. It's because of its mass marketing. I always say to people, I always find it interesting that people are willing to accept little snippets of truth if they're contained within fictional writings,
mm-hmm,
rather than a hidden truth contained entirely throughout a book.
Right, right.
So the Da Vinci Code, in some subconsciously way, has prepared the path for this rediscovery of this ancient knowledge.
And this rediscovery of the ancient knowledge, is this something that you feel that you are right on a target in regards to what you are writing about, or is this something totally different? Do you know what this is?
Rick, I have to tell you that if we back up a little, one of the reasons I feel that we're right on target is I have been immersed for my full life within this Masonic, Knights Templar, full Freemasonry spirit. I come from a very long line of Knights Templars, military men, and I've been immersed as such. And it was 15 years ago that I discovered that my great uncle, who was like a grandfather to me, he was, in actual fact, in the 1950s, Supreme Grand Master of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a young teenager, he showed me something, symbolism from an ancient ring that he possessed, that only in the last 15 years that I've been able to apply it to my research. And I believe that the research that I've developed, and I'm my biggest skeptic, my own biggest skeptic, has pointed me to the area where I believe I will discover in the near future that ancient knowledge that everybody so much desires.
Care to share with us what that is?
Certainly. People always ask me, is it the Grail? Is it the physical Grail? Is it the genealogical records of the family of Jesus? Is it the holy bloodline? I always say to people, the Grail can be considered on many levels. The treasure can be considered on many levels. It is everything that we talk about, but it is really nothing that we talk about. To me, it is this ancient knowledge that has been perpetuated from before the Great Flood.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back into the ancient Masonic teachings, this is really what they identify as being the secret. It is the secret word of God that is being perpetuated through man prior to the Great Flood. Knowledge which allows you to apply it on a number of levels, to deal with everything from alchemy, changing lead to gold, to really changing the whole human genome to achieve long-lasting life and longevity.
Hmm. That's interesting. Boil this down, so to speak, this is about a secret word of God. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And that word has been entrenched within the continual DNA of the holy bloodline or the holy family.
Hmm.
That word has been brought forward through the human genome from ancient centuries. And there is a method that I've discovered where that word can be retrieved through essentially initiation and memory work, the two basic tenets of Freemasonry.
Hmm. But what is the connection between a word and genome? How can a word, or are we talking about something, if we were to translate that into a scientific term, I guess we would talk about a frequency. Is that what you're talking about here?
We're talking about either a frequency or a code.
Mm-hmm.
I refer to it as a code. And that code allows us to really center in on where this physical treasure has been resting for at least 400 years.
So is it resting in a person that is alive today?
In part it is, but in part it is lying underground in an area that I pinpointed in North America. This is the most interesting thing. A number of people in Europe believe that this physical treasure still remains within Europe. I've been able to trace it through a Prince Henry St. Clair. In 1398, Prince Henry St. Clair, at the time, was hereditary Grand Master to the Scottish Knights Templar,
mm-hmm.
and he brought over to North America, within 13 galleys, this physical treasure. But, again, we're talking about many different levels, many different spiritual levels. He brought a physical treasure, he brought members of the Holy Bloodline, he brought a number of levels of the Grail treasure with him.
Hmm.
And sought refuge in the inner sanctum of North America.
Okay, you're mentioning Henry Sinclair. Maybe we could dive into a little bit and talk about the split then that occurred, because at the beginning, of course, the Knights Hospitallers, or the Knights Templar, of course, was a Catholic order that was, I don't know if they were sent out by the Pope, but they were under his command, so to speak, and they went down to Jerusalem, of course, dug around there. Is this where it all began? And is a consequence of what they found there also the reason for the split that occurred?
This is where it all began. The royal families, the Holy Bloodline families that came together in Normandy, France, which really initiated the First Crusades, the original nine knights went to Jerusalem and sequestered themselves within the Temple of Solomon. And in the underground, they did discover, whether it was mapping, whether it was writings, whether it was physical treasure, they discovered something that would confirm that they were on the right path, this path of ancient knowledge, this continuous path of ancient knowledge before the Great Flood. And that's where the schism did occur. After that discovery, back in France, there was a argument between the two main families, and that's where the splitting of the knowledge occurred in 1127 in Geysers. And part of it was that you were dealing with the southern Davidic families, which came up through the Middle East, and you were dealing with the Norse families comprised of the Sinclairs and others, which came out of the north. And they both felt that they were the main representatives of this knowledge, and that they should be the perpetuators or guardians of this knowledge.
Okay, let's backtrack even more and let me ask you, because you say holy bloodlines, define that for us and what makes them holy? I don't understand that.
Well, the holy bloodline is this notion that there was a bloodline that developed out of a union between Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene. And if you question whether that union actually occurred or didn't occur, it really doesn't matter. What we're talking about is the holy bloodline out of the kingship families, out of the house of David and house of Bethany, Mary's family, that came together in a number of ways, and this holy bloodline perpetuated this continuous ancient knowledge, whether it be subconsciously within their own DNA or consciously within their mind. They realized that it was a perpetuation of this knowledge that came together through the first crusades. And what they discovered under the Temple of Solomon confirmed to them that they were on the right track.
So what happened with the knowledge itself? I mean, when Prince Philip of France went after the Templars, he must have done so because of a, you know, very good reason, so to speak. And what was that? That, to me, implies that he knew.
Philip was not only seeking the treasury of the Knights Templar, but more importantly, he was seeking this ancient knowledge. Now, the Knights Templar, the way they were obviously one step or three steps ahead of Prince Philip. What they did is that they split this ancient knowledge into four parts. And that knowledge sailed to Scotland, sailed to Denmark, sailed to Portugal, and I believe the fourth part of that knowledge sailed directly to Nova Scotia, located in the New World across the Atlantic.
Right.
Because at that time, the Knights Templar were the ultimate marine sailors. They possessed the ultimate knowledge, which allowed them at that time, and we're talking hundreds of years before Columbus, allowed them to virtually circumnavigate and control the world seas.
And where did they get this knowledge from? Because, this, I mean, at the time, I guess it was, you know, the common thing was that if you sail too far, you know, you're going to drop off the edge of the earth. But what were these guys doing, and where did they get the knowledge from?
This was part of the knowledge that they discovered under the Temple of Solomon during the First Crusades. But more importantly, it was the knowledge that they confirmed. The Knights Templar, their original enemies were the Muslims and the Moors of the Middle East. But they developed relationships where they were able to combine the Western knowledge that they had with the Eastern knowledge, which really verified the ancient maps that they had rediscovered under the temple. And by this, they were able to establish long before it was common practice in the 1700s, they were able to reestablish and reconfirm that there were ancient meridians, longitudinal meridians, established around the world based on certain energy points, which they could tap into and verify, and therefore allow them on a very accurate basis to sail around the world. And if at this point in time, as you mentioned, Henrik, at a time when the church was promoting that you would fall off the edge of the earth as you moved past the pillars of Hercules coming out of the Mediterranean, this allowed the Templars to have absolute control of the trading and of the natural resources which were abounding across and around the world. I believe that the Knights Templar were making fairly regular journeys right from the First Crusades on to North America, and we're trading with the native North Americans 1,000 years ago.
Very interesting. And how did they know, the Templars I'm talking about now, how did they know where to look for this ancient knowledge, and how did they know that it even existed, or was this an accident that they stumbled upon this?
No, this is where masonry, a lot of people claim that masonry, the York Rite Masonry, was originated in 1717.
Right.
But the Scottish Rite Masonry, which is filtered through Scotland and back through France, back through Europe, that masonry, although it's been obscured a little over the last 1,000 years. That masonry has continued for at least 2,000 years. That base is the masonry. Now, it may have been called something else at that time. There was an inkling 2,000 years ago of these ancient sacred geometries. The Greeks talked about them. The secret societies of the Greeks talked about them. The Egyptians employed them. The Romans employed them. This basic knowledge was available over 2,000 years ago in pre-Christian times. And it was remnants of this knowledge from the Great Flood. If you know masonry, if you know masonry history at all, there's talk within its basic ritual of a continuation of ancient knowledge from before the Flood. And this knowledge can be found on the two pillars that were maintained through the Flood, because they were made of clay and stone. One is Boaz and one is Jacob.
Right.
The original pillars of the temple.
Yeah, okay. So this is what you're talking about here, I guess, goes, as you say, back to Egypt. It was picked up by the Greek and later by the Romans, perhaps then. But the of course, one character that pops up here is of course, Hiram Abiff, as one of the architects, I guess, to Solomon's temple. Is this where you're saying that the original knowledge is coming from, or do we go even further back than this?
We go even further back. Hiram Abiff is only a symbol. In Christian masonry, they need to pantomime this ancient knowledge through rote, so that through the memory work, that through the various rituals, the various orders, it can be portrayed. Hiram Abiff is representative of that morality and of integrity that a Mason should portray throughout his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Hiram Abiff, he was the one, the chief architect, that possessed this secret knowledge, the knowledge of the sacred geometry.
I see.
He did not give up that knowledge, even when he was accosted by his three apprentices. There's a moral to that story. It's dealt with on a number of levels, but the moral to the story is that he demonstrated integrity, morality, and loyalty to the brotherhood that he was working for, and he maintained those secrets. That's all that is at that level. But of course, Hiram Abiff possessed this sacred knowledge, which allowed him to construct the Temple of Solomon,
mm-hmm.
or Solomon.
Mm.
You have to deal with it on a spiritual level, a metaphysical level, and a physical level. There are three levels which you apply Masonic teachings.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You were talking about the Great Flood too, of course, that this goes back before the Great Flood. And one thing that too comes to mind in regards to if there were knowledge about America that was found in under the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, to me it implies potentially a little bit that this actually has to do with the well, I don't know. Do you think that America actually is Atlantis? If you follow my train of thought there, so to speak.
I wouldn't want to speculate on that. I don't think, I don't think American is Atlantis. But what I will tell you is that I believe that the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, Mesopotamians, all of those ancient civilizations were making regular trips, transatlantic voyages to North America.
Mm-hmm.
And had established regular trade routes, and we're continuing to trade with the North American Indians and the South American Indians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there was great interaction. And part of that interaction would be marriage and social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was also travel between South America, North America, and Europe.
Right.
It just wasn't a one way. But because it was so valuable of a commodity, this is what really evolved as one of the secrets. If you possess the knowledge for unlimited trade, you wouldn't convey it to royalty. What we've seen is look at the king of Spain. The king of Spain virtually raped Central and South America after Columbus supposedly discovered it. There's a prime example of what not to do. And this is in part the morality that we're talking about from a Mason, from a Knights Templar. They were of the societies where they, and there's a very famous saying, they came in peace. They came in peace. They were part of the social interaction with the Aboriginals, and they treated the Aboriginals on the same level with respect, with almost as royalty. And that's what they accomplished. And that's part of the moral lessons that we learn out of what's being portrayed here. That was one of the reasons why it remained a secret for the last 1,000 years.
But this, this has changed today if we were to talk about the same thing in context, especially if we consider... If we drag royalty into this picture, because today many of the Freemasonic orders that are around as their chief protectors have, people of noble, elite, and royal family bloodlines. So what has happened here? I mean, have they infiltrated the orders afterwards? Is that what you're saying? Or have they been the protectors of them all along? What's going on here?
Well, they were originally the protectors of this royal bloodline. But unfortunately, greed gets everybody. And you're right. Over the last 300 years, Masonry has been infiltrated. And it's been infiltrated since the introduction of York Rite Masonry in 1717. The English took over Scottish Rite Masonry and sort of whitewashed it of all the pagan and ancient symbolism that you would find. And now it's more of a brotherhood, and of course the royals saw a real opportunity with the opening up of North America to instill their power over another continent and to obviously increase their income tenfold. So this is where you're right. They've infiltrated. They've assumed because of their position. The Masonic orientation and the Masonry that we talk about now, although there are vestiges and small inklings within the ritual itself, within the order itself, the Masonry and the Knights Templar that we talk about now, although there is a small connection to ancient Masonry, is really a different type of Masonry altogether. It's just a fraternity. It's a brotherhood. It's a in part a good old boys club.
Right.
But there are very few, as I refer to them as the old timers, very few that recognize within Masonry itself that the rituals perpetuate this knowledge. You have to look deeply into the ritual itself to find inklings of this ancient knowledge that has been perpetuated for centuries. And in part, a lot of this knowledge relates to the application of these longitudinal meridians and astronomy across the world. The Knights Templar, probably the greatest asset that they possessed was their navigation ability.
Right.
They during the Crusades, possessed the greatest seagoing knowledge of any facet, including the Muslims and the Moors. Around the world. It allowed them to ship hundreds of pilgrims, soldiers, and their wares and their supplies across the Mediterranean to Jerusalem at a time when the shipbuilding was archaic at the best.
Right. And I guess that this also, I mean, many people today do go back and track the Knights Templar, see that because of their ability in regards to trading and so forth, managed to become very wealthy, meaning that they was actually they were the first ones who actually set up the what kind of we can compare with the modern banking system today. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And it's interesting that Switzerland, which is known for its banking, has virtually the reverse Templar flag.
There you go.
As its natural symbol.
Right. Exactly. Well, I mean, many people, you know, tie this back to the World Bank, of course. I mean, the World Economic Forum is based out of Davos in Switzerland. So, I mean, it's there's so many symbolism, so much symbolism today that still, resonates, so to speak, with what has been going on. Tell us a little bit, if you will, about the symbol of the balanced cross, as it were, because this is not the Christian cross. This is a different one. What does it represent or mean to you?
Well, the balanced cross, a number of people apply a variety of crosses. What you have to look at is not the symbolism. It's not the Christian cross, although it has the red and white, and it's representative of the Templar colors. But you have to look further at the application of the crosses. It's really the cross of Lorraine that is the most important symbol.
The double cross.
The double cross. And the cross of Lorraine really speaks to one of these major holy bloodline families that was able to, through certain manipulations and through crossbreedings, and when I say crossbreedings, we're talking about centuries of strategic intermarriages, almost cloning, to maintain and to strengthen the holy family bloodline, the DNA.
What are they up to? What are they trying to do here?
I don't think they're up to anything. It's again, it's not a matter of greed, but it's a matter of purity. It's a matter of truth. What they're trying to do is they're trying to maintain for when that time that we're really talking about, and I don't want to get into this as being so serious, the second coming of Jesus Christ, of Jesus. Now, I consider Jesus to be a great prophet, but in Christian Masonry, you venerate the teachings of Jesus, not
the person itself.
The person itself. Well, I was going to say not beyond the person.
Okay.
I consider Jesus, as Muslims do, for him to be a holy prophet. Nothing more, nothing less. He was a great man.
But why is it so important then for his return?
Well, look at what's happening around the world right now. We need leadership.
Do we? Aren't we? It feels to me a little bit like we're having, you know, too many leaders, too many voices out there screaming to,
Do you really consider them to be leaders? That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Well, right.
We need leadership. We need something that can pull together all of the world. And what better way than to identify that member to be part of the holy bloodline, to be a direct descendant of Jesus Christ?
I mean, is this of interest to, how should I put it, the man on the street? I mean, this seems to be a very kind of small circle of, again, very elite bloodlines already that seems to be very interested in this particular area, don't you think?
It is, but let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. We really need the elite bloodlines to recognize their leader. There are so many so-called elite bloodlines out there doing so many things in the name of God that are atrocious.
Right.
All the world wars that we've had, all the major skirmishes, all the atrocities that have been committed over the last 2,000 years, and I hate to say it, the Vatican has been involved in a lot of these,
have
been done in the name of God.
Right.
We really need a leader that speaks, that has the ability to bring all these factions together, that speaks with one voice, voice of God, and whether it's the supreme being, whether it's nature, whether it's a pagan god, whether it's a spiritual god, all of those things, whether it's just a higher energy, all of those things. We need a leader that is, through his bloodline, is able to achieve this higher level of consciousness and morality and loyalty and some semblance of reasonableness around the world.
So you're saying that normal, quote-unquote, people today aren't capable of pulling this off and living in this way? Or I mean, again, I'm having a little bit of difficulty just understanding why this person or this, you know, descendant of a specific bloodlines would be so important in this case. I see today that it's about people individually waking up and taking responsibility for their own lives and not entrusting in a leader. That's how I see it.
I agree with you absolutely. I believe that everybody has the ability to discern, to reason their own way of life, their own direction, and to discern between and the reason between good and evil. But there are certain factions out there, and I hate to say it, these factions are a lot of the interbred bloodlines that really need a leader. Unfortunately, they're controlling the actions around the world. They really need a leader that brings them together.
Well, okay, wait a minute. Pause that right there, because this is interesting then. Okay, so what you're saying is that potentially here is we have a situation where we have a lot of wealthy, rich people within the so-called bloodlines that are having their own interest, meaning that to some extent they are financially behind a lot of the world wars because they have the wealth to do this, but they're doing this for their own particular reason, and they themselves might want to sit on the throne, so to speak, of the world at the end of the day. This is like a big, this is a game in a way, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a world game of chess. And what you're finding is that really history is repeating itself. When Godfrey de Bouillon, as a Grand Master of the Knights Templar, that when they took Jerusalem, the Holy Lands, for the first time, he was offered the kingship of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
He had the judgment, the knowledge, the wisdom not to assume that position. He became the guardian and protector of Jerusalem. Now, his brother, after Godfrey died, he wasn't so upright and standing. He took the kingship for his own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But what we need to do is we need to be able to verify that somebody possesses this strain to the point that he's able to bring together all of these factions, these bloodline factions. Factions that believe that they have superiority for whatever reason over the rest of us.
Right. So this
is the little guy. It's not the little guy like you and I that I'm worried about. It's the ones that manipulate and control the wars. And I hate to get into the politics that are happening now within the United States, but I think that's a fine example in terms of self-serving prophecy.
But I mean, some people would say and would argue, I guess, that, for example, when you are part of the Knights Templar, you're actually helping to facilitate this kind of situation. I mean, to a certain extent, I understand it, because if we look at it this way, that what is going on today, for instance, in regards to the U.S. and Iraq, some people see that as a continuation of all the crusades that has been going on, you know?
Certainly, but I have to point out to you right now that the Knights Templar that I'm involved in, the Masonic organizations, there may be individuals that have some influence outside the organization in terms of some of these activities, but these modern-day organizations are nothing more than fraternities or brotherhoods. I present all the information that I'm discovering to them. All I do is get blank faces.
Really?
Yeah, really. They love to hear this because they love to feel that they are part of ancient ritual that has been perpetuated, but they have no inkling, and don't get me wrong, they're the finest group of gentlemen that I've ever met from a moral point of view, from an outstanding point of view, from a business point of view, but there's nothing more. Now, Now, there may be some individuals within the organizations at the highest levels
mm-hmm.
that are using those organizations for their own benefit.
Right, right.
But for the most part, these are just brotherhoods and fraternities. They have lost all of their purpose, other than getting together and supporting one another. Now, they're fine organizations, and they turn good men into better men, and they help individuals along and all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep on telling people that I know more secrets from the fraternities that I belong to in university than I do belonging to the modern-day organizations that I belong to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my situation, I always knew that I was going to be part of the Masonic Order.
Why?
That it was part of my family. That it was so entrenched into me.
Mm-hmm.
That it was part of my family. But if you ask me if I have two sons, whether they will continue, I really don't think so, because I think the organization is dying out. The organization, the Templar organization that I belong to, the average age must be about 80 years old.
Hmm. Willie, I'm back a little bit more away from the phone, if you will.
Certainly.
So what is happening here then? Is the interest in the organization diminishing, and why is that, do you think? I mean, to one level, then I guess that many people looking from outside and in just see this kind of as I do, is a bunch of old men, you know, doing nothing in particular, and if not that is the case, then probably the case is that they're behind some nefarious activity, meaning that they themselves are involved actively in some kind of conspiracy. That's I guess how the main consensus is. What do you think about it?
No, on the most part, what the organizations are irrelevant in today's society. Younger fellows would rather be with their families, working on their business, and taking their kids to soccer.
Right.
These organizations, from my point of view, are irrelevant in today's society.
And
now, that's not to say that there may be some individuals within the society. You know, when the societies are weak and the memberships are falling greatly. The death rate is every year surprises me. That way of life is changing. The Masonic organizations, they really saw their strength coming out of the First and Second World Wars.
Mm-hmm.
It provided a bonding. It provided a brotherhood for the fellows that were coming back from the war.
Well, exactly, because, I mean, many orders started out as a branch of the military. It was a kind of an extension of that. And
exactly.
And, of course, there are wars today, so that's not what I'm saying, but there aren't those kind of large wars, especially not in regards to Europe. I mean, Britain, of course, is involved in the war again in Iraq, but, I hear what you're saying. But what's really happening
is that there is a little bit of a resurgence, and it's because of Dan Brown's book. It's because of the two movies, The National Treasure.
Right, right.
I get more inquiries from fellow members in terms of really, what is Dan Brown, what he's saying, is there any truth to the matter?
Mm-hmm.
I get more inquiries out of that. I'm finding that the individual members have a hard time accepting that they are, in fact, part of an organization that does, in some way, support a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. And are they? or are you, I should say?
Am I supporting a conspiracy?
Yeah.
No. No.
Well, so tell me about the movies and the books here then. The Da Vinci Code, National Treasure, who is behind them? Is this a recruiting campaign on one level?
No, not at all.
Okay.
You know what it is? It's a unique opportunity for the fellows that are writing the books. It's like identifying what is popular at the time, picking up on that, and building around certain truths,
mm-hmm.
and developing it in a fictional manner that it is really quite entertaining, and I really enjoy
right.
watching these movies, because right. I probably, of anybody, see a lot more symbolism in the movies than even is intended. And I sit there and chuckle
exactly.
and laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so, the interesting thing is that I don't know if any of your readers have seen the National Treasure, the original National Treasure movie. That starts out, there's a vignette at the start where the grandfather explains a story of their family involvement centuries ago with the founding fathers of the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
A number of them were Masons.
Right.
And he explains the Knights Templar treasure and the continuation of the treasure. And the whole movie is based upon that. That is taken out of my first book, The Knights Templar in the New World.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The first chapter is I speak about this ancient symbol that was shown to me by my great uncle, who was like my grandfather, because my grandfather was dead at the time,
mm-hmm.
Shown to me when I was a teenager.
Mm.
And there's that direct correlation, and they built upon that, and then the story takes off.
Do you think someone has take a peek in your book and snatched it, so to speak?
Oh, I know they did.
Really?
Oh, I know they did.
Okay. Have you been in contact with anyone from within the research of the movie itself?
Yes. They phoned me a number of times, and they were asking me a number of questions. And this is one thing that I find with the information that I've uncovered. I always say no one person has all the information.
Right.
Has all the knowledge. And it's like in talking to you through this radio program, I find that, and I can guarantee you that as soon as I do this radio program, as I've done with a number of other programs, people will be searching me out from around the world. I'll come home one day and my wife says, somebody from Australia was phoning trying to find you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Everybody phones and they always claim that they have a little piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always because their great uncle was a Mason, high-ranking Mason. Their father was involved in it. They believe that they are a remnant of this holy bloodline. A branch of their family ties mm-hmm. back into certain royal lines, Merovingian lines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I have to tell you is that what's really interesting, I'm working on my third book. And one of the things that I've always asked myself is, why me? Why is all of this coming to me? And a number of the older gentlemen who I've talked to always suggested that, say, my dear boy, it's in your bloodline.
Mm.
And so one thing I've been doing is I've been researching my bloodline for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that the Mann family, I have a number of Sinclair friends through the Sinclair research.
William,
project.
William, hold on right there, because we're going to do like this. We're running out of time here in our first segment, and what I'd like to do is dive into this area in the subscriber section.
Okay.
But before we do that, though, I want to talk a little bit about your books. I want you to mention the titles again. I also want to, you should give out the website where people can go and get your books in case they're interested in finding out more about this.
Sure, that'd be great. The first title of the book is The Knights Templar in the New World, and that's available at www.innertraditions.com. Inner Traditions is my publisher out of Vermont, but it's also available in most of the larger bookstores in North America here, I know. In actual fact, I know it's available in some of the bookstores in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The second book is called The Templar Meridians, The Secret Mapping of the New World, and it's really a continuation of the first book. In the first book, I talk about the Knights Templar coming in 1398 through Prince Henry St. Clair and 500 Templars, and bringing with them what they considered to be the Holy Grail to Nova Scotia, what is now Nova Scotia in North America, and developing strategic interrelationships with the Mi'kmaq Indians, the Native Indians. And the second book, this Templar Meridians, picks up on this notion that this group of Templars with their Grail treasure, along along with certain bands of Indians, moved inwards through North America. Hmm. And it was only through the strategic intermarriages of the Templars and the Native Indians that this was made possible. Again, that book is available at www.innertraditions.com or through your local bookstore.
Mm, fascinating. And that's a little area that I do want to dive into here in our next segment to talk about the intermarriage, so to speak, with the Native Indians, what was happening there, and also a little bit about the Grail, a little bit more about your potential connection to the Sinclairs and the DNA aspect that we haven't kind of dived into yet. But so much more is to come here. But before we round things off here, I want to ask, do you or your order have a website that people can look at, you know?
Well, we do have a small website,
mm-hmm.
but I would suggest that you not go to that, because that is just the typical order website.
Okay.
I'm developing a website. It will be www.templargold.com,
mm-hmm.
Because in part I'm off on this trek now with a number of relations that I've developed through my DNA with Native Americans, and we are going treasure hunting, and that will be part of a documentary over the next 2 years that we're developing, and we're following the trail of Prince Henry St. Clair, his Templars, and his Native guides across North America to the western United States, where I believe that the Templar treasure and also the bones of Prince Henry St. Clair are buried.
Really? Okay. Well, I definitely want to ask you a little bit about that here in the next segment. Red Ice Creations members, tune in to our very interesting continuation with William F. Mann, as we'll discuss the Sinclairs, DNA research, longevity, bloodlines, the Grail, the Vikings, and the Native American connection. If you want to hear our continuation, head on over to redicecreations.com, and from there you'll find out how you can sign up and tune in. Thank you for listening, and my thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren behind the controls. Upcoming guests, we have David Cerida and David Flynn, so do stay tuned. Until next time, take good care. This is Henrik Palmgren. Talk later.
There's no chance for us.